will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Quam moves to approve the minutes from February 22nd, 2018. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes that need to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted and the minutes are approved. First bill up today is Representative Peterson. And since she's already there, Representative Peterson moves that House File 2945 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill you have before you, House File 2945, is a simple bill to help streamline the licensing process for building new intensive residential treatment services, commonly referred to IRTS facilities. You may have known that I served on the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, and one of the outcomes of that work was noted that IRTS are lacking in our current mental health system. So under current law, before a provider entity can even start the regulatory process to build a new IRTS facility, the Department of Human Services, with the Department of Human Services, that provider must already have a contract in place with the host county. Obtaining a contract can usually add at least a year, if not more, to the development timeline. This bill eliminates the requirement that an IRTS provider must have a contract in place with the host county. However, it's important to note that the bill does require new language guaranteeing that counties may continue to be involved in the process. An IRTS provider must provide a statement of need from each county in the proposed service area. The statement of need must specify if the county does or does not support the proposed new program. The bill also specifies other documentation that must be submitted to the commissioner as part of the licensing process. This bill will help speed up the process of developing new IRTS capacity. In 2016, the Minnesota Hospital Association commissioned a study looking at how many inpatient mental health days could have been avoided if the community discharge options had been available. That study was done with only 20 participating hospitals, yet the study found that 639 hospital days could have been avoided if more IRTS beds had been available. Hospitals need more availability of community discharge options. Our goal is to improve patient flow, helping individuals receive care in a less costly setting. Individuals prefer this IRTS care setting over lengthy hospital stays as well. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and there are no concerns by the Department of Human Services. Jane Quinlan with Health Partners is here today, also in support of this bill. Health Partners recently paid for and built a new IRTS facility in Maplewood, and the county contracting process slowed down their project significantly by over a year, even though the county was in support of the project. So thank you for your support of this bill. And this is a picture of what that new IRTS facility looked like. And Jane, if you'd like to come up and share your state your name for the record and share your testimony in regards to
that. All right. Thank you, Representative Peterson. And just for general housekeeping, you withdrew your author's amendment for this bill, right?
Yeah, there is no amendment.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Quinlan. If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. My name is Janie Quinlan, and I'm the Director of Community Services for Regents Hospital. I've also oversaw our two IRTs for 22 and 13 years, respectively. I'm pleased to announce that next month we're opening our third facility in Maplewood. To prepare for my testimony today, I look back on the timeline of the development of this project. We began discussions with our partners in Ramsey County and DHS in October of 2014, and it was exactly 2 years later that we were actually awarded an RFP through Ramsey County and the ability to go ahead and proceed with the development of our new facility in Maplewood. The development of IRTS is a very collaborative process. We rely on our partners at DHS and Ramsey County and our host county for our funding, GRH, and the other mechanisms to provide this service. The contracting, we found, while we had the support of Ramsey County and the support of DHS, it probably added about 18 months to the process where we were finally able to begin the development of the site and the actual facility.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Quinlan, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony.
Sure.
I'm just really curious, what is it that goes on during, or what went on during those 18 months?
2 years? actually, we began meeting with DHS and Ramsey County, first of all, to talk about the need. As the largest provider of inpatient mental health beds in the East Metro, we saw a real need to have further capacity for ERTs for discharge. We actually did a time study ourselves where we determined that at any time we had 17 people, an average of 17 people waiting an average of 2 weeks to be discharged to an ERTS. And so we wanted to provide that statement of need and the our need, not only as Regents Hospital, but the East Metro, Greater East Metro, to Ramsey County and DHS. And it also took time because Ramsey County has an RFP process, and so not only did we, for the new facility, have to participate in RFP, our current ones did also, and ongoing we're going to have to every 3 to 5 years participate in the RFP process so we can have this contract, which is not a financial contract. It's merely an approval by the county for us to provide this service.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So, well, you know, I have no objection to the bill that I know of. I mean, it sounds fine, but I'm just kind of interested in we're making this big change in process, and I just kind of want to understand better what the change really does. And so with the, if I could, the, so it sounds like there's some overlay with, I know St. Paul has some, this, what we call the RFP process for St. Paul, but that may be unique to St. Paul. And I'm just, this bill is though is a statewide bill.
Quinlan.
Thank you. Prior to the adoption of the ERTS variance, we were previously Rule 36, and that was a county-funded program. And so not only did the county fund that program, they also were the gatekeeper. And so all the people that we served as a Rule 36 were funded and funneled through the county. Once the ERTS variance was adopted, the funding streams changed. And so the county no longer was the funder for this service. It became through DHS and the state. So we have two funding streams. The county provides us room and board, and the state provides our program fees.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Ms. Quinlan, thank you for your testimony this morning. The committee thanks you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say that this bill is about reducing bureaucracy and helping move towards that goal of getting the right care at the right place at the right time. And I appreciate your support.
All right. Questions for Representative Peterson. Representative Liebling.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Could you I hope you kind of understand what my just kind of missing piece of information is here. I just want to understand, you know, it's great to reduce bureaucracy and that, but, you know, the procedure that is there now was put in there presumably for some reason. And can you just sort of explain what was that doing or supposed to do that we don't need anymore, that we can just change it and, you know, streamline it, as you're calling it? I mean, you know, are we losing anything by making this change?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. Thank you for the question. I believe that this is still keeping the counties informed, and so they play a role, but they don't have to go through a lengthy RFP paper process that just to allow something that they know is a good thing for their community and addressing those concerns and getting these kind of services available to the people that need it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Any other questions for Representative Peterson? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2945? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and provide us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholen, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just wanted to say that we are in full support of this legislation. You know, I think originally in terms of why this had to go through the county was to make sure we didn't overbuild our mental health system. Frankly, I'm not worried about that at all. We have a lot to do yet, and we really want to develop these facilities and these programs as quickly as possible. We already will have, you know, frankly, issues in terms of developing them in certain cities, like I certainly found out last night. That's already a hurdle, and we don't need this additional kind of bureaucracy to slow down the development of very much needed facilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Abderholden? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Any final questions for Representative Peterson? Then with that, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 2945 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2945 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Next up, we have Representative Kreisha. And Representative Kreisha is moving that House File 2952 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kreisha. When you are ready, the bill is in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the motion is to take this to civil law and not to the House floor?
That is your motion, Representative Kreisha.
Okay. With that, I'll introduce the bill. Mr. Chair, this is just simply a recodification. All we are doing is putting like things with like things and rewriting the statute to make it a bit cleaner. There's no substantive changes, just simply moving words around.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 2952? All right, if you could please make your way forward. When you get down here, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name is James Dunn. I'm from Hoyt Lakes, Minnesota. I've actually had to file child abuse, file for help with social services, and the system's broken. I don't know if anyone had an opportunity to read this bill. I don't, you know, it seems like this is just a procedural thing. But look, here's a section out of, it used to be 626-556, subdivision 10, section 5. It says, in cases of alleged child maltreatment resulting in death, the local agency may rely on fact-finding efforts of a law enforcement investigation to make a determination of whether or not maltreatment occurred. When necessary, the local welfare agency shall seek authority to remove the child from the custody of the parent, guardian, or adults with whom the child is living. In performing any of these duties, the local welfare agency shall maintain appropriate record. That's what I call the final blow law. So if there's a dead child, investigate it, then remove the dead child, then write a report. I'm telling you that this process for CPS to remove a child from an abusive situation takes years. People are not experts in their field. If you look at the statistics from CPS themselves, mental health is less than 1% of all reports. Over half of them are screened out. The resources aren't there. I'm tired of seeing dead kids in the news. House of Horrors is, you know, just a few days ago. There's no attention to get this, you know, to fix this as a priority of any party in Minnesota. And our kids are left in these situations where we can't do anything to rescue them. And, you know, as a father, as just advocates for other people going through the same problem, try saving a child from an abusive situation. Only government can do that. I would say try it yourself if you think otherwise. And I get it that this is a procedural thing. There's a lot of good language in here, but it's not enough. I mean, this still has the same language from the prior bill. You know, I call it the final blow law. Look into it. It's too thick. you know, if we're gonna measure success with child protection, measure success by the ability to take swift and effective action. And 500 pages of legislation isn't swift or effective. 3 years of court and of county prosecutors and of people who aren't experts in their field is not effective. This is not a good way to protect kids. And, you know, there's a quorum here today, and everybody brings bills in front of this committee. But, you know, I don't know, there's other committees. I've seen the list of bills that we have in front of us this year in the session. There's from bike trails to changing the state flag to building buildings to community projects. Child protection needs to take a priority at some point in Minnesota, or we're going to keep seeing these things in the news. And I'm one guy. There's lobbyists all over saying, you know, this is time for groupthink is over. We need to make change. And that's my testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Don. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Thanks for coming in today and for testifying. And could you just maybe just very, very briefly just say the one thing about your experience that you found as the greatest obstacle and your biggest opposition within the bill currently?
Mr. Don.
There's a lot, and I'm happy to have an offline discussion. I have litigation in process, so I want to kind of dance around this a little bit. The opposition is that on one hand you have lawyers telling you don't go to CPS or social services because that'll slow the process down and they're not going to do anything, and the judge will look at that and say, well, they're handling it, leave it alone. On the other hand, when you have so many, you know, stack of police reports like this and you're trying to protect a child or multiple children, there's no process. I mentioned mental health. Less than 200 cases in 2014 processed for mental health abuse. I had a situation where I asked social services, well, this is a mental health issue. I mean, this is mental abuse. And they said, well, we don't do mental. There's nothing. It's either physical or it's not. I said, well, okay, let's get to the point where these bruises can be eliminated and I can go 3 weeks without another bruise. And I couldn't get that through. So I can't get the mental health taken care of for the reasons that some of these things happen. I don't have adequate engagement from social services. They see, okay, well, this dad is looking at changing custody for obvious reasons. This is a custody issue. We're not going to touch this. I have social services sitting down with me saying, well, Mr. Don, you should be careful about what you're saying. And I can read between the lines. They're saying, if you say any more, I mean, this could be a false allegation. If we can't prove it, and look, the standard for proving abuse is videotape evidence in some cases. If you have pages of documentation of bruises happening over and over and over, and you're asking the simple question, formulated so that you don't get yourself in trouble, please make these bruises stop. And that's all you can say. You can't bring collateral information. You have to be very careful about your wording because they're ready to end this conversation. This isn't as clear-cut as, oh, this is a drug addict home and the family's unstable and this is a clear touchdown. This is more of a fumble with a half, you know, foot out of bounds situation. It's the edge case, and these kids have to deal with it. Nobody's there speaking on behalf of the kids. It's a big gap in the situation. If it's not clear abuse or neglect, they're not ready to act. And I just say, you know, in this particular case, there's plenty of evidence, but one child was removed, and you know, he was restored to the family after about a month, and I asked the child, who's a sibling of the one I'm concerned with, I said, well, what's the situation? And he goes, well, no one believes me. I said, well, you're old enough, you're 9, you have all sorts of audio devices, record it. Well, the CPS name was Dennis, and he goes, well, Dennis said that if we report any more and there's multiple kids involved, we're all going to foster care and we won't see each other ever again. That's from the CPS agent, and I heard the father tell me the same story. These people are sick of dealing with these cases, And with all good intent, I mean, I know they've had good intent, but they called this a high-risk situation, and I had no follow-up, not a single phone call. Of all these reports, not a callback. I had to call and say, is there an open case? And they said yes or no. This process is, you know, I had to hug a tree if I wanted to pick up one of the pieces of paper on this piece of legislation. It's not swift. It's not effective. And I don't know what to say other than we need to change it, and it needs to be a priority before these bike trails and buildings and everything else. And it's not just that I have a bad situation. It's that I know of many others, and we see them in the news. And the ones in the news are like, hey, guys, we missed this. And it's the state. It's not a party. It's not a particular individual. It's not a law enforcement agency. They say, well, this is a civil issue. Well, no, it's a child abuse issue, and no one can stand up for the kids. And no one will put it as a priority to pass any bill to make it any better. The groupthink stuff is tried. We've tried it. It gets locked up in recommendations and everything else. How about we give people access to remove a child? That message that I cited, that's the only statute that I could find in that law that even talks about removing a child. The rest of it's buried in DHS and CPS process, and who knows what that is, because that's a very private, you know, process that you don't have visibility as a citizen to see what's their screening procedure. So I would say let's reach out to some people that have filed reports before. Of the 50%, the 20, 30,000 a year that get filtered out or screened out, how many of those were probably, you know, illegitimate? How many of them were just afraid to say what was really going on? And we missed it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious, you're not the first person that's had issues with, caseworkers, et cetera. And did you have or felt you had an avenue to consult an ombuds person or someone outside of that direct action so that you had an independent entity that could look, you know, had the authority to look in and review it?
Mr. Dunn.
No, and there's another father involved, and he reached out to me, and he said, you know, this is a big deal. And him and his wife were ready to give up on the kids because you couldn't, this is, they're stuck. There's no way to get in front of this. You know, like I said, from the police to social services to child protection to lawyers and judges, I've seen it. I've seen there's still pending activities, and I'm very, very hopeful that someone will make good decisions at some point. But I was here a year ago saying very similar situation, you know, similar thing to, I don't know if it was a different committee body, but it's a struggle and it takes a long time. But to be able to call up someone and say, hey, can you review this? Is there anything else I can do? I mean, you exhaust everything, and that's in fear of going too far. That's in fear of saying the wrong thing and appearing like your motives are suspect when you're just trying to save a kid or multiple kids. And Child Protection says, hey, this is a high-risk situation, and they build a safety meeting, and they get 30 people in a room, and it goes to the county prosecutor twice, and nothing happens because it just isn't enough. Well, I read the statute that's why it's just not enough, because they can't remove a child until it's dead.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, I've had conversations with constituents and people that, you know, weren't in my district but had issues. And one of the things is the feeling there's now no power, no independent entity they can go to and talk to, because the people that they know or have an opportunity to talk to are part of the decision. And I think we're never going to have a perfect law, but I hope that we can, you know, this session or next session, sometime actually look at giving the support that might help, you know, people be able to have access and feel as if they, you know, the system hears them. And I want to thank the testifier.
All right, thank you, Representative Quam. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2952? Any questions from members for Representative Kreisha? Final word, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I appreciate the testifier. I actually didn't know I was going to have a testifier today, and I'm glad he joined. I've asked DHS to talk to Mr. Dunn as well to talk through his case and to see if we can come up with some things that come out of that. A couple of comments, and I agree with almost everything he said. This law, though, what you have in front of you is just a rewrite of the statute. We're just trying to clean it up because, frankly, one of the problems that we've had is we've amended this and changed the law so many times with so many different strategies that we've made it messy. And we need to clean that up so it's easier to read, so that we have a more refined statute in front of us when we're working through these issues. To that point, I will address some of the comments that the testifier brought up because they're important. And, you know, he gave me a perfect opportunity for my soapbox, and that is, folks, this is the biggest issue I believe we face. This is the heart of everything that we end up dealing with as juveniles and adults move through the system, because at this stage, we have kids that are being treated so poorly and in so bad of situations, and the trauma they experience cannot be shaken off. And then they end up looking to chronic addiction. They look to opioids. They look to everything to try to fix those. And I'm not saying the system is the answer. Unfortunately, the system is the response. It's the only response we have, because by the time that child is reported, most of the damage is done. And we spend a whole lifetime trying to unravel things that have been done to children. I do not know the testifier's specific case. I certainly share his frustration, and I understand how hard that must be. But I got to tell you, we're reporting over 70,000 kids a year. The way we are treating children in this society is absolutely horrible. And we can't fix that legislatively. We can't fix that with an opioid bill. We can't fix that with a gun bill. We've got to fix this at the basic fibers of our society. And that's a fact, folks. I mean, if you think the problems we have today are bad, wait till these 70,000 kids move through the system into grade school, junior high, and they become adults. And more families fail, and more children are had. So, yeah, this is just a rewrite of the statute, but we've got to address this issue. And I've been doing that. I'll continue to do that. We have a training bill coming up where we need to train more social workers, because they're getting trained and then they're finding out how hard this is and they're dropping out. I mean, can you imagine the trauma of having to deal with 15 to 30 cases a month when you go home and you know you're not going to make a difference, because at the end of the day, there's going to be parents and adults that are going to make decisions that you can't change, and to watch that over and over and over. And so I'm certainly not a bureaucratic defender here, but I'll tell you, we're responding to a situation that society is handing to us, and that's got to change. But this bill doesn't do that.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisha, thank you for the work that you've done on this, and I'm glad you're a really strong advocate and really keep dogging this issue. And I agree with you. This is one of the biggest issues we face. And even larger than that, you know, how are our kids growing up? And how are we giving them opportunity to be successful? Because it's not only a negative going forward, as you just said, but a tremendous missed opportunity. We know that our state is only going to be successful if we have everybody participating. We just cannot afford, if we ever could, to let anybody fall by the wayside, much less be a negative. So I guess the question I have for you, and I know we're really sort of a little bit
off the rails.
I get that this is only about recodification, but nevertheless, we've had a good discussion here today. And I'm just wondering whether you or what you've thought about in terms of prevention, because, you know, if we're obviously we have a system where we come in after the fact and we respond to reports, and we're always going to, in a system like that, no matter how much resource we put in, we're always going to miss people. We're always going to have failures. We try to minimize them, but it's horrifying to all of us to think of a child who's in a bad situation without a response. That's horrifying. So, you know, have you thought about, or are you working on anything that gets us up out front of that, that helps parents, be better parents, or that helps identify early when situations might be, you know, there might be a need for more resources way before it would get to the maltreatment stage?
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I appreciate the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, the response system is always going to be very expensive if we don't get to the prevention, obviously. And that's a difficult fact. On the prevention, and remember, you know, we have to deal with the response because we do. The prevention side, obviously, is very, very complex. And, you know, no state has figured it out. I've been to many of them. We've talked about this, and we're all struggling with it. The hard part about this problem is we all look for answers. Nobody has them. And so the reason I bring that up is, I mean, this happens at the localist basic level of our community. This happens in the churches. This happens in the schools. This happens when a family walks by another family that knowingly knows they're struggling and doesn't stop to say, how do I help you? That's where this starts. And we don't have the moral mechanisms that are in place to take foster kids in. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example of try to be a foster parent. My wife and I are trying to work through that now. And the bureaucracy and the levels that you have to go through just to take a kid out of a bad situation for 24 to 48 hours, and I don't blame our system. I blame us. We keep putting things in place because we feel good about it, and we say, let's add this piece of bureaucracy. Let's make this home. Let's just get people willing to take in kids. And you know, I would say, I mean, we can make a whole list. We can whiteboard this out. We can create all the post-it notes we want and strategize it. But the basic fact, we have to find a way so that when a family is struggling, another family or a community mechanism steps into place to help that family get back on their feet. A lot of times I will see cases where a father loses his job and goes through the most difficult period of his life, or a wife or a mother goes through something and nobody is there just to help him get through. And the father does the wrong thing. He maybe goes out to drink. He tries to take care of some situation. All the emotions come out, and it comes out the wrong way. A lot of times that's the problem, is somebody reacts to a bad situation in their life in the wrong way, and nobody's there to help them out. And government can't do that. Government can't be in those homes to put an arm around them or to take the kids away for a weekend to say, you know what, let's work this through. And we're doing that. I say we collectively, we are doing that. We are missing the boat. I mean, how many of us in this room or in this legislature are going back and trying to figure out, how can I just be a foster parent for 24 hours? So that when a parent comes home and the sheriff shows up and says, I have to pull this kid out for 24 hours, where do we put that kid? We don't have any spots. So in a lot of cases, these kids are sitting in homeless shelters. Or the kid becomes the victim. The kid becomes the one that sits in the back of the police car and feels like the perpetrator, when the parents are the ones that are struggling. Representative Liebling, I wish I had the answer. I wish I had the magic wand. I wish I had the superpower. But this has got to come from our community. And this has got to come from us doing better as human beings. And I don't know how we get there. I'd love to write that law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. With that, Representative Kreshaw renews his motion that House File 2952 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2952 is referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. Up next is House File 2574, Representative Dean. As he makes his way up front, Representative Dean moves that House File 2574 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. And Representative Dean moves the DE-1 amendment And then there's an amendment to the amendment. Is that correct, Representative Dean?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, I'll move the DE amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Dean, you have moved the DE-1 amendment, and you also want to move the A. You now want to move the A-1 amendment to the DE-1 amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. To your amendment, Representative Dean.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, this is a bill that gets at rare diseases, which we have dealt with and you have or will deal with constituents. With rare disease, Minnesota is uniquely positioned with the University of Minnesota as a national and world leader in rare disease research to take a little bit of a lead on this. What it does is this allows families with family members with rare diseases to be able to use their collective power to be able to come together to find therapies and cures for their family members that if you have a rare disease, oftentimes you are faced with trying to research on your own, trying to find a path that hasn't been cut by anybody else. So this really provides some mass to people with rare diseases to be able to band together. The amendment A1 adds a section that allows the council to examine the issues with people with rare diseases when applying for or changing their health plan. The DE gets the bill into the shape and really kind of narrows it down with the stakeholders of the group, that being Mayo, the University of Minnesota, and our research community. So that's really kind of framing up what the group will do and who will be involved. That's what the DE amendment and the amendment to that gets at a little bit.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dean. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted to the DE1 amendment as amended. Any questions on the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form that Representative Dean would like to present it in? I'd see none. All those in favor of the DE-1-1 amendment as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Dean, to your bill.
When we're looking at rare disease in Minnesota, one of the things that it's important to keep in mind is that as our research grows and becomes more specialized, that all diseases become a little bit more rare. Cancer in particular is being divided down into more specific variants, and even research in at the University of Minnesota and at the Mayo Clinic is looking at patient-specific types of cancers and therapies in the programs that we're looking at right now. So we see unlimited availabilities for therapies and cures, not just for the rare diseases that just a handful of people in the state or the country might have, but how that really can affect and lead therapies and cures and miracles for people with more common diseases like cancer. What we're really finding is that all diseases are a little bit different from each other, so they are all rare, and that particularly the research going on in Minnesota on rare disease can actually help more folks than just the people on that. Now, you will find when you talk to constituents, particularly parents with children with rare diseases, that they are really on their own path. They have to become researchers themselves. They have to become advocates, lobbyists, funders, fundraisers in order to chart a path to try to help their kids. And that's what parents do, and they do a great job. But what I think is an opportunity is to really help parents by allowing them to group together for this from an advisory council standpoint is the first step for the University of Minnesota to start down that path. And down the road, what would be even better would be to allow ways for parents to directly connect with therapies and, more importantly, in many cases, clinical trials that might be available in other states for their children that might be the best fit for their kids. So that's really what this is attempting to do. We have a lot of great parents, parent advocates who brought this forward, and also we've got a great opportunity with University of Minnesota, and particularly with the new dean of the medical school, uniquely positioned with Dr. Toller, who is just a great world advocate for the research in rare disease, that we can find miracles right here at the University of Minnesota and help families here in Minnesota and across the country and around the world. So with that, that's a description of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Do you have any testifiers for this bill?
I believe so.
All right. If they could please make their way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honored members. My name is Pat Lang, and I'm here in support of the bill H.R. 2574, and actually my child is one of the miracles that this guy was talking about. She was supposed to only make it till 2 when I brought her here from Ohio. She's almost 21. Thank you, University of Minnesota. I'm speaking as a parent of a young child with a rare disease, as well as for all of the families that call my office at the Pacer Center, a nonprofit that helps navigate the healthcare system for children with rare diseases. Imagine, if you will, you're going to have to help me. I'm sorry, but it's the only big pictures I have unless you want to look at my Facebook. Imagine, if you will, meeting the darling little girl pictured here in purple. See, she's the littlest one. They're both my girls. She's just over a year old, and she's my youngest daughter that I adopted from China. She looks healthy and happy and was sharing a joke and a laugh with her sister and I. Now, imagine her 15 years later, on her 16th birthday, spending her birthday money in Target on a purse that she can't carry and the orange high-heeled shoes that are higher than any I've ever seen in my life that will never touch the ground. That infectious smile is still there and continues to capture the hearts of many. She now has a wheelchair for legs. Her breathing is supported by a ventilator, and 100% of the nutrition comes from a feeding tube. She can no longer call me Mama in Chinese or in English, as a matter of fact, or even speak at all. She communicates with eye blinks for yes or no and a switch-activated communication device occasionally. She's 20 years old now and intellectually on target. And you should see her when she sees a handsome man. I'm sorry. I had to throw that in. I'm sorry. She has a positive attitude and a zest for life that amazes everyone she meets. And she has a silent laughter that brings many to tears as well as sets off her pulse ox, and she struggles to breathe because she's laughing so hard. She has a very rare genetic disease called metachromatic leukodystrophy. You won't be asked to spell it. Just remember it. It's MLD for short. It's one of the 7,000 rare diseases that can affect individuals at different onsets during their lifetime. Since my daughter is adopted, I have no genetic or medical history of any kind to rely on. So diagnosis was very difficult and took me 2 years to accomplish. We lived in Ohio when I started to notice changes in the way she walked. With tremors in her hands, she struggled to reach for things. I left no stone unturned as I searched for answers. I contacted a doctor in Connecticut that was with me in China when she was adopted, and he immediately said, bring her to me. He saw the changes and spoke to doctors in Ohio with his findings, but that wasn't a cure. That wasn't a diagnosis. More tests were ordered, results were studied, but no answers were found. Some doctors were stuck on a diagnosis they couldn't prove. Others said, let's just wait and see. as I sat in her room telling all involved that we weren't leaving the hospital without better answers, a young doctor walked in to see if she could help. After she spent 2 hours with us and then studied all of the previous tests and data, she called me and said she might have an answer, but needed one final test, which proved to be the key that opened the door to the disease. She had seen it once, where? The University of Minnesota, where she did her residency. A family with 5 children, 3 of them had it. Little did I know that the fight for her life had only truly just begun. She got us, the doctor got us the attention of a doctor in Minnesota that also was world-renowned for this disease and other metabolic storage diseases. After a phone interview with him, I tried to figure out a way that I could get my family here and did the best I could with the car that I had. I left my family behind in Ohio, and my girls and I moved to the Ronald McDonald House in Minneapolis for tests. 2 bone marrow transplants, and a year later, I went back to Ohio to find myself trying to manage my new life, my job, and medical bills beyond belief. I missed the security of being around a medical team that understood the disease, and I sold everything and left my family support team and moved us to Minnesota forever. But the fight for her life, despite being cared for by an unbelievable team, keep losing my place, of medical professionals, did not get easier. After all we had given up to get here, it just didn't seem fair. I fight for the medicine she needs because my insurance and Medicaid won't pay for drugs that they have no evidence that will work for a disease they don't understand or know. I fight for them in a suspension, which means a liquid format, because she can't take anything by mouth. Duh, you're the insurance company. You see her records for 20 years. You don't get that, but they won't pay. We are the evidence. They don't understand. I fight for durable medical equipment, home nursing care, hospital stay extensions. Insurance companies think they know more than doctors taking care of us. I beg for evening doctor appointments so I can keep my job and my insurance. Friends and neighbors raised money for us in 2016 when the state put a lien on my house, even though I was working, paying taxes, and doing my best to make payments every 2 weeks. This is the reality of rare diseases. We need a team of dedicated people with experiential knowledge and medical knowledge to find and implement solutions for all of these issues, cancer, autism, heart disease. Why not rare diseases? Please help me just be her mom. Take up the battle for me and all the families like mine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Lang, for your testimony this morning and taking the time to come and visit us and share your story with us. We greatly appreciate it. Are there any questions for Ms. Lang? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Chair Dean, do you have any other testifiers this morning for us?
Nope. Oh, one more? Sorry.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gabriella McCann, M-C-C-A-N-N, and I'm a parent advocate from St. Paul. Like my fellow parent just said, there are approximately 7,000 rare diseases, and of those, only 500 have a treatment, not a cure. And this was my daughter's case. She was born with epidermolysis bullosa, which is a rare genetic disease, incurable, painful, devastating, and progressive. The only available treatment in the whole world was here at the University of Minnesota, and so we moved here from Italy, where we were temporarily relocated. It was here because Dr. Toller, the dean of the Minnesota Medical School, has devoted his career and his life to find a cure for this disease and potentially proven effective for all genetic disease by correcting stem cells. But in the meantime, he developed an experimental treatment, that a bone marrow transplant, that gives more time to patients like my daughter that don't have it. So the day came probably make it to the cure. Unfortunately, that didn't happen for my Elisa. She passed away 45 days ago. Rare means so many things. Means hard to get a diagnosis, hard to find a physician that knows the disease, and hard to get specific drugs, like she just said, covered by insurance, or procedures covered. Hard to get research funds. It's a niche. Biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies are not captivated by such a small market. All this, it's added to the daily struggle that the family have to endure every day. I firmly believe that a rare disease advisory council will be the perfect link between patients, legislators, physicians, and scientific community. I believe that it will facilitate the understanding of the unique challenges that the rare disease research has from bench to bedside. And also, I think it will help the state maximize resources. With a comprehensive knowledge of the needs and challenges of patients by streamlining many winding processes where a lot of the funds get lost, state funds. We went through all the hoops and loops of many processes, and I do have already a couple of projects that I will submit to the advisory council. In my experience, the state of Minnesota is one of the most organized and caring. Yes, it was for us. I have seen family in other states struggle greatly for basic medical needs. And this is why a rare disease advisory council will be a great addition to a task force, to a work team, and the accomplishment will be outstanding. Because of the work of Dr. Toller, my daughter had a longer life, 5 instead of the 1 expected. But many children won't have that chance. There's simply no cure or treatment for them. If we can all work together, we can put a cap on the number of patients and families that have to go through what our family did, because nobody should. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCann, for bringing your testimony to us this morning, and we are sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2574? Are there any questions for the bill author from members? Seeing none, final word, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Ms. McCann, sorry for not recognizing you earlier when I didn't see you come in, and our condolences on the loss of your daughter. And it was Rare Disease Day at the University of Minnesota, and it was a great conference last week about one of the researchers specifically highlighted this insidious disease that unfortunately took her life. And the promise of gene editing at the University of Minnesota to be able to identify these specific genes that actually can be manipulated and for the promise for a cure in our lifetime. And some really exciting research at the University of Minnesota, so we should all be excited about that and very hopeful for the future. And hopefully this will be a way that we can do that, help parents, and also help the research going on here in the state. So I'd appreciate members' support.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 2574, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2574, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Shifting gears a bit, Representative Dean now moves that House File 2725 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Representative Dean, we have the bill before us. Hear your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2725 looks at county-based eligibility determination systems for Minnesota Care and for Medicaid within our public, state public programs.
This is a continuation of the work that I have been chiseling away at since Minsure became our state exchange program and has been rolled out. And part of that began with traveling around, as many of you have with me and on your own, to do cubicle ride-alongs in your counties, small counties and large counties, to sit with county caseworkers to actually see what the process for signing people up for public, for state-funded programs, how that works, and how it works from the county side and how it works from your constituent side as they're going through that process. Much of this has been within the launch of Minsure and the inability for counties to be able to respond to that and to be able to help the people that they are chartered to do, to help. And on typically what I would do, in counties, some counties are small and some counties are large. You know, Olmsted County has 100,000 people in it. Cook County has less than 5,000 people in it, but both counties have to kind of do the same thing in dealing with our state-funded programs, and that is trying to make sure that the families that need help get the help. When they go to CVS, their cards work, they get their prescriptions. When they go to the doctor, they can get seen, and the doctor can get paid through our public programs. And it was through that process that I kind of started down the path of looking, instead of looking at DHS or at the a new agency to try to figure this problem out, and it was clearly a problem of how to deal with this, to really look to the counties. And what I would typically do is meet in late afternoon with the counties at a hospital to try to get with county caseworkers after we would do a cubicle ride-along, then meet with county caseworkers at a hospital to try to get feedback at the end of the day so they could say kind of what was working, what wasn't working. And then we would do a town hall at night to hear from insurance brokers, business people, people trying to buy the insurance. And it was at one of those late, the third meeting in a county in western Minnesota that this kind of came from. And where it was we had the insurance brokers and the people from the counties were at the town hall, and one, they were talking to each other, and it was just a discussion that had broken out between the county caseworkers who were there and the insurance brokers. And the county caseworkers had discovered that they were talking to people during the day that needed to be on private health insurance, and they really couldn't help them. And the insurance brokers were saying, well, that's funny. The same thing is happening to me in reverse. I'm talking to people and trying to get them on public programs through my office, and they were trying to do each other's jobs through a system that was meant to integrate them that never, ever, ever worked and screwed it up for both sides. So what we kind of tried to look at was, okay, what's the solution here moving forward? And really there's two suppositions. Number one is that the idea is to separate private health insurance from the people in your counties that deal with people, families on our public programs, to get them out of the private health insurance business, if you will, and vice versa. So we create a new bright red line that says that we're going to do state-funded programs at the county level, and we're going to get them out of the private health insurance business, and we're going to allow private health insurance brokers to sell private health insurance to families who need it, try to get them more competitive products, and to separate those two. And the second idea, if you will, is to say, who is going to design this system moving down the road? Is it going to be the legislature imposing another agency on people and on counties? Is it going to be on an outside entity? Is it going to be DHS? Who is going to be actually figuring this out? And the idea with this is that there's the unit of government that is closest to the people who's actually tasked with doing this job is the county. That's how we're set up in the state. 87 counties, and all of them are responsible for delivering state-based program care to families. They had done this 10 years ago. They'll do it 10 years from now when hopefully most of us will be on doing other things. They're going to be the ones tasked with that job. And as I traveled around the state and talked to counties, actually small counties provided the best input because they were the closest to the families and they knew many of the families directly. And also the county caseworkers were involved in more than one program in smaller counties, and they provided the best level of support. So 5 years from now, 10 years from now, those same families are going to be in the 87 counties, and the county caseworkers are going to be delivering care. So if we're going to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars on IT for eligibility determination and for providing care, which we are absolutely positively going to do, who is the best group of people to lead that process? And what this bill says is that it's the counties, because they are going to be closest to the delivery, and they are the group of folks who are directly accountable for that care. Now, that's the two main ideas of this. If this were a building that I was designing, this would be at the phase where you have a thick Sharpie marker, and you would be diagramming the building. That's the phase where this is at. That's the idea that we're going to be putting forward within this bill, is that the county should take the lead on designing their next system. So that actually is something that we can do for the counties rather than to the counties. And I don't blame counties for being skeptical. If I was a county, I'd be skeptical too, because the rug has been pulled out from under counties over and over and over again. You're understaffed, you're behind in trying to catch up, and okay, here comes another idea from government that's supposed to help us, and meanwhile, we're just happy if we can get a widget to work from the helpline, pretty pleased. So I do not fault anyone at the county level, local, small, or large, for being skeptical, as you should be, of any either fixed dementia or replacement of it down the road. With that, those are the two main ideas behind this bill. And no matter who the next governor is, what the administration is, I am going to believe that we are going to have a pretty big change within how this gets done. And I would really like to put forward the idea that the county should lead. And so that, in a nutshell, is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I understand you have a couple of testifiers, if they could make their way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and your testimony.
Yep, Tim Jepp. So I'm one of those brokers that had those meetings, and you know, we were frustrated 4 years ago. You know, we've been involved with MnSure for a number of years, and it's been a frustrating process for the first couple of years. But the experience has changed. We work very closely now with people that can help clients get on the county programs or the Medicaids and the MnCares. 4 years ago, it would take us almost a whole day to get somebody enrolled in the process. Now it takes us about 20 minutes. And what we do, the process has changed for us too. We used to enroll a lot of people in the Medicaid program when we shouldn't be. But now we work closely with companies that's their expertise, is to enroll people in the county programs. So we vet the people now on the phone. And we're getting these people calling us from through the MnSure website, through our own advertising, and also from the county. The county's actually sending people our way now too. And we vet them on the phone and talk to them and see, are we the people they need to talk to, which is the broker? Should they come to us? Or should we send them on to the proper person, which is, you know, we use mainly Portico as one of the companies that we use. And we send them over to Portico if it's a process that we can't do. So our experience from 4 years ago to today is much different. Like I said, we're seeing people getting the process done in about 20 minutes, but then also sending them to the proper channels and making sure people get the insurance that they need. So
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jopp. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Representative Dean, do you have other testifiers?
I think somebody from the counties would like to testify.
Welcome. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Hodan Goulet. I am CEO at Breva Health. Thank you so much for the opportunity today. So Breva Health is a grantee and official partner of Minsure. Our partnership with Minsure has helped us build the largest outreach and enrollment program in the state. Our enrollment centers serve more than 25,000 Minnesotans per year. And our centers are actually open every single day, 9 to 5. We work year-round. We work with the counties and more than 100 community partners who refer people to us, who help us conduct outreach activities. So to date, we've actually conducted more than 1,000 outreach events that reach more than 80,000 Minnesotans per year to help them, you know, educate them about Minsure and what their health, what their options are for coverage. As I said, we collaborate with more than 100 community partners who help us reach and refer consumers to our services, including the counties. As of today, we've actually helped more than 30,000 Minnesotans enroll on health coverage just at Breva. We're a small business. We have, you know, more than 16 certified Minsure navigators who work very closely with the counties and with other, partners. Every month, more than 20,000 Minnesotans are helped by Minnesota's navigator and assistor network, just like ourselves. And this would definitely not have been possible without Minsure and without the grant that we get from Minsure, which helps us go out there, educate the public, and help them understand what their options for coverage are. At Breva, we work with Minsure every single day. Like I said, 9 to 5, we're open year-round. We process, you know, people who qualify for the public programs as well as the private programs. The county is one of actually our largest referrals, and it's definitely something that we do on a daily basis, 9 to 5, I can tell you. And I am here to tell you that we just completed our fifth open enrollment period with Minsure, and I can tell you that this year was Minsure's most successful year yet. Minsure is working better than ever in serving the unique needs of Minnesotans. Minsure continues to improve every single year. It has just set a record, as you all know, for sign-ups this last open enrollment period, with more than 115,000 Minnesotans signing up for the private health plans, 60% of who received tax credits that average nearly $7,000 per year. And in total, Minnesotans are poised to save over $300 million in tax credits. This year, consumers' call wait times, which we call all the time because we are assisting consumers in person as well as over the phone, averaged less than 10 seconds. So when we call to help, you know, to get something done over at Minsure to either help a consumer change a password or help them push a case or help them with their application process if there is a need, it was literally taken 10 minutes for the Minsure staff to pick up. I mean, so that should tell you how efficient the team, the system have all become. At Breva, we know firsthand how far Minsure has come. We witnessed the tremendous amount of time and effort Minsure and its stakeholders, including us as well as the public who currently use Minsure, have really all put in to get to where it is today, to serve the unique needs of Minnesotans. So it's really imperative for us to continue to build on the success of Minsure and not risk families to lose the system and the services and the coverage that they've come to rely on, because now they're all on board. They finally know about Minsure. They finally know where to go. You know, and as you all know, I mean, you just saw probably one of the surveys that just came out, which pointed out, you know, with the public programs, more and more people are enrolled than ever before. And it's all definitely because of the Minsure system and the Minsure program. So, many of these people who currently have health coverage would not have it without Minsure and its assisters like Breva. So this bill definitely takes us backward, guys. this bill is a solution in search of a problem, and it's unclear what benefit this new system will have. Given that the current system is working, creating an entirely new IT system is a waste of money. I think it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. Our goal here needs to be to make it easier for consumers to acquire health insurance, not make it more cumbersome, not make it more complicated for them to restart and relearn everything all over again that we've worked so hard in the past five years to just be completely destroyed would be ridiculous. Now is not the time to go backwards. So I am here to just tell you that and to just let you know that we're here witnessing it firsthand for the last 5 years. We've put in all that we could to get Minshew to where it is, and we should definitely not go backwards and destroy what we've built together. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Goulet. Questions from members? Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Goulet, I see a different point of view on Minshew. I have constituents that call me. They're not happy. They don't like the runaround. They don't appreciate having to call various people throughout the state of Minnesota to get an answer, to facilitate. Most of the time they give up, and then they're calling their legislator with the hopes that we can find a secret channel that's not advertised to the public so they can get help just a little faster. If Representative Dean's bill, House File 2725, becomes a law, what happens to Abreva?
Ms. Goulet.
Thank you. So Abreva is here. We definitely do not anticipate that this bill will pass because too many Minnesotans currently depend on this, on Minshew. And too many Minnesotans know the system and have learned the system. I am here to tell you that over the 30,000 Minnesotans that we've helped enroll, they don't go all over the place. They now know a resource, a trusted resource that they can come to, that are there to understand their needs, that can serve them in multiple languages. We have more than, navigators that speak more than 8 languages. We serve Minnesotans all over the state. We currently have an online system where people can just set up appointments over the phone. We're able to help Minnesotans not just in the Twin Cities, but really in rural areas where if there aren't navigators, they can call us. The Minshew system has a portal system where a navigator can get on the phone and we can automatically assist them over the phone. And we've done it more than ever in this past open enrollment period.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Goulet, today is the first time I've heard of Abreva. So I don't think many of my constituents even know that Abreva exists.
Mm-hmm.
However, so what I'm hearing, though, is if this bill does happen to get passed into law, Abreva may not exist, correct?
Abreva will continue. And thank you for the next question. Abreva will continue to exist because Abreva's services are services that truly are used by Minnesotans. It's particularly in the places that we have existing offices, which is here in the Twin Cities. In Minneapolis, we have 2 offices, and in St. Cloud, we have another office. And then we have the capability, as I said, to assist, Minnesotans all over the state who need our services. Abreva will continue to exist because we also work with other programs, other companies, and we provide other consulting services and other research-type services. So we will continue, but we are very I would like to say that I'm pretty sure that those 30,000 people that we've helped so far will be devastated if they found out that next year when the open enrollment period comes along, there's nowhere for them to go. And they will have to completely restart learning something that they don't understand. It literally took us years to go out there to tell people about Minshew, what Minshew is, how to sign up. We're for the first time ever signing up people who've never had health insurance before. So we are their source. We are their trusted source. They're coming to us for anything related to health insurance. And we're for the first time helping those people go to and get preventive health care instead of their, what they used to do was they used to just go in to the emergency room because they didn't have health insurance. But for the first time now, they have something where they can go in and get the care that they deserve for themselves and their families.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, so you serve the function of navigator. Is it easy to find a navigator? How would I go about finding, to Representative Franzen's point in a community, like how are navigators found? Are you listed on websites? Mm-hmm. Are you publicly advertising? How easy is it to find a navigator in the state?
Exactly.
Ms. Goulet.
Thank you. So a lot of times the way people find us is multiple ways. So we ourselves get a grant from Minsure, which helps us go out there, advertise ourselves, collaborate with different partners all over the state, and they send people to us. So say, for example, if there is like a homeless shelter who has, you know, people who have never had coverage, we would go out there, do, an outreach event there, tell them about what we do, send, and then they would learn how to get to us. So we distribute materials. That's one way. So from our end, and that's really made possible by the Minsure grant. The other option is if people go to the Minsure website, there's a really beautiful engine on there. You can go on there, put your zip code, your address, and then it pulls up all the navigators that are available. There's more than almost 1,000 navigators across the state that people can identify just through their address. And then the county has also become we've become a resource for the county because, like, say, for example, if the county can get overwhelmed because there's thousands of people that would show up and, so we've kind of become a resource for them so that if they can handle it, they would also be sending people to us. So we have referral partners that have, been working with us. I mean, at Breva itself, we have more than 100 informal partners that work with us.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hear that sounds very similar to what's true in my community, that you can go to our public library and literally stumble upon a navigator. You don't have to go to county services. They're throughout east to west. Our city's 20 miles long, and there's navigators in food shelves, homeless shelters, right where people are. So, it sounds like you're showing a similar thing, that there's a tie between having navigators where people are and the accessibility to enrollment.
Exactly.
And am I hearing you correctly in saying that with what's here, there may be risk at people not being able to access enrollment help in a way that's accessible in their language in a community place that they trust?
Yes, thank you. Yes, definitely. So, we have, I think, over 100 organizations and navigators that are available all over the state that provide services in multiple languages, and they're available across the state. So when you go to the Minsure website, you could actually put in a search for enrollment event, and it pulls up libraries, community centers, community partner venues that they can access navigators. And, it's the dates come up, the times where they're located. And that would definitely, of course, not be possible if people have to go through the county, which isn't accessible all over the state. So it's definitely a lot more personalized, a lot more unique to the needs of particular populations, and that's why I think we've been so successful in signing up so many more people than before we had Minsure.
Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Goulet, you obviously come to this presentation fairly well versed in insurance and benefits. I'm just wondering what inspired you to establish Breva?
Ms. Goulet.
Thank you. We started with just the need that we saw and for becoming a bridge between really communities, especially hard to reach communities, and companies and other state services that provide some sort of health-related service. So we thought there was a need to kind of just bridge that gap because we saw a huge gap, in terms of hard-to-reach communities not getting the services that they needed. And so that's how we started initially, and then we coincided with the Minsure launch. And so we thought, well, this is definitely a great area for us to get into because it kind of services both what we were committed to do. We are a for-profit small company. Minsure has allowed us to build this really efficient, robust navigator program that we have right now. And, so if it wasn't for Minsure, I don't know if we would have hired as many people as we did, if we would have opened as many offices as we did, and be able to provide service to all these communities that really, truly needed our services. and now we're able to do so through the Minshore program.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Goulet, so you're a for-profit, which means that you obviously have a profit and loss statement that you look at on an annual basis that determines whether or not you're an ongoing and thriving concern. I'm just curious in terms of your grant that you received from Insure, how did that play into your planning? And is it an ongoing or is it a one-time grant that you received from Insure?
Ms. Goulet.
Thank you, Chairman. So the grant that we received from Insure is an ongoing grant. So to just give you an example or to give you just a quick history, we started with a small grant the first year. We got like $130,000, okay? In that year, we enrolled about maybe 1,200. So we went from that, okay, to getting last year $340,000, and we enrolled, not assisted, because assisted means you've helped so many more people with all kinds of other stuff, but just enrollment into health coverage last year, we've helped more than 13,000 Minnesotans just last year. So just imagine how much cost saving, right? So we went from spending maybe $80 enrolling per person in our first year to like $26 by the fourth year.
Mr. Chair.
So that's a huge investment.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Goulet, if I were to look at your profit and loss, obviously your reliance upon the grants is not a small amount. So would you say that your reliance upon the grant money from the state and from Minshew is what percentage of your overall profit and loss statement?
Ms. Goulet.
Thank you, Chairman. So it's about, I would say, about maybe 40%. But I do want to let you know that this is a grant, that we have to spend 100% of it on the Minshew program, running the Minshew program. And I will tell you, so all those enrollments that we do, we also get a per enrollee reimbursement, right? So for us, that's where we would hope to get a profit. And I was just looking at our profit from last year, and we've literally spent almost everything. Our profit was like maybe $70,000. Very small. So we're spending the grant, plus a lot of the money that we're getting from the per enrollee payments, because we're processing so many people. And the per enrollment rate that we get isn't really enough to cover all the people that we're. So we're literally functioning like a nonprofit at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Goulet, I think you're proving my point. I'll summarize here. Your reliance upon the state and Minshew is for almost 40% of your overall operating budget, and yet you even admit that you're relying upon even more than that to enroll people in Minshew, a program that has been wrought with inefficiency. You even said yourself, just imagine if the counties were able to process those people on their own, notwithstanding the good work that you do for the people that you serve. But just imagine if the counties had a program that didn't require an outside vendor to process the people that come to them looking for assistance for county-based programs. Just imagine if $340,000 in the last year wasn't expended on behalf of an outside vendor for a program that was supposed to be implemented and processed by the county. Just imagine if we had a program that served the people of the state of Minnesota in a way that didn't require extra people to help people get what they needed. Just imagine that type of program.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier and members. So kind of like what I'm hearing is that we have a Minshew that 4 or 5 years ago came into realization and had technical problems. And over the years, it has become more efficient. And it's now enrolling in an incredible amount of individuals who are now have coverage for themselves and their family. And the one thing I think we know about counties and state is that often they cannot do the work that needs to be done to reach the people back out in the community statewide. For some reason, they are not able to do the work that needs to be done to reach the people who need it in the language, in their community, the way an outside vendor can do that work. And so what I heard from this testifier is that I heard the awesome work they're doing to make sure that children, mothers, families are getting the service that they need through Minsure. And has done a wonderful, wonderful job of outreach to make sure that they are connecting with people the way the counties and the state have not been able to do. And we hear that because the counties are partnering with an outside vendor. And so, as we look at, whereas we want to create a whole new system that makes it more difficult for folks who now have coverage to look at something new. We have 87 different counties. And my question to Representative Dean, we have 87 different counties, and sometimes people move from county to county. And I think I'm hearing you say that each county would do what they do, how they want to do it, with no way of talking to each other, no way of I've been able to support different community members who are moving from county to county. And so as we are, as you think about creating something new at this point, that we know anytime something new happens, it takes time for it to gel and to be effective, as we now see Minsure is doing, what would an entirely new IT system built from scratch look like? How effective do you think that would be, and what would that look like in day one? And has the state built other systems from scratch, and it's gone well?
Chair Dean.
Well, great question, Representative, and the answer is we don't have such a sweet, awesome track record when it comes to rolling out IT systems for eligibility determination and for program enrollment. Before I got elected, there was something called Health Match, which was a system that was designed to match enrollees with the programs that they were eligible for, and it rolled out with a gigantic and expensive thud. And it never worked, and left us with a legacy system that Minsure then developed on top of. Rather than learning from the mistakes of that, which was too audacious, a rollout too quick, didn't leave time to check to see if the systems actually worked, to just impose a gigantic IT system on the state, we did exactly the same thing again, except there was no backup and there was no net, and so all of the people that couldn't get served were left in the lurch. Counties had to hire people to try to catch up, and they're still not caught up, and it still doesn't work. And we currently, and we will see in here tomorrow, of the money that the administration wants to spend trying to yet again do Minsure 3.0, where we're going to find out that they're going to be spending not tens but hundreds of millions of dollars in additional money to try to redo this yet again. And so what this does is it sets up a governance system that says, let's get the right voices around the table to design this thing, and let's not do it until we get it figured out, and let's not pull the rug out from underneath the feet of counties or, more importantly, enrollees around the state. So that's the idea. It doesn't have timelines. It does not have strict design other than to say that the enrollment period needs to match the IT capability that we have to put it out.
Thank you, Representative Dean, for that plug for your own committee.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair.
Members, just a note, and I'll get back to you, Representative Moran. We have 12 minutes left in committee. We will be voting at 10 o'clock. We have Ms. Ring, who will also like to testify. And on the list for this testifier, we have the follow-up from Representative Moran, Representatives Quam, Liebling, and Grunhagen to go. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you want to create poor people? I came into this body in 2011, and there was much debate about an exchange of what we was going to do here in Minnesota. We did nothing. And then in 2013, we came into the leadership, and we was up against a crunch of a federal mandate to get something done, to get the federal waiver and to get the dollars that we needed, that was crucially needed for something to happen here in Minnesota. And it did. We did. We put it together. We rolled it out. We got the dollars that we needed to roll it out. And what we did learn from that is that there was an explosion of people on that system, that we found out that the IT system just couldn't handle it. Well, here we are 5 years later, you know, and with any new system, any new technology, anything new, it takes time. And the thing is, what do we learn from that? What do we learn from something that rolls out like this? And I hear you state that, you know, you're going to put a group together and you're going to take your time to make it happen. But so we want to repeal statutes and rules that authorize and govern the operation of MnSure, right, effective upon federal approval of the waiver. I mean, what did that look like, Representative Dean?
Representative Dean.
Section 4 of the bill directs the Commissioner of Revenue to seek a 1332 waiver from the administration in order to do that. That would allow state flexibility in designing our own system, and it would allow us to continue to use what we have until we have something better.
Representative Moran.
And is there a cost associated, Mr. Chair, is there a cost associated with this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, the costs within that are within the existing appropriations that are available, that are still available, and I think that we're going to be looking at how those monies are going to be spent, but I think that that makes sense for us to look at something that can actually last beyond revenue streams that are going to be coming to an end.
And I end with this last question. And my hope is that, you know, we have a small business in front of us who has been doing a great job of enrolling individuals into our system. And my hope is that we're not here to attack the great work that the business is doing, but see the value that she has brought into a system that many of us thought was broken, that is now, you know, have enrolled more individuals and families as ever before, and that we recognize that she is a job creator, you know, and from what I hear is working, like, extremely hard and has not received much of a profit besides the profit that she has ensured that families are covered. And I think that's a job well done. So I just want to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I'm confused because I thought this bill was about having a working functional system to support our counties. We've heard a lot about enrollment, even though from 2015 to 2017, the percent of uninsured in the state of Minnesota increased by 2%. So we hear a lot about, this is wonderful. Well, from non-functional to quasi-functional, is an improvement. Wonderful would be something that actually works without requiring additional entities outside of it to try and appear functional. And, you know, basically this bill is aimed at the end user actually being able to define a system that will work. And I don't know of anyone that hasn't received, you know, pick up the phone, read your email, issues with the system after they've signed up. And if you talk to your counties, I would love to hear your county people, give me their names, that actually don't have a problem with the system You know, and then I'll join you in saying, oh, kumbaya with what we've got. But our citizens deserve their counties to have a tool that'll work for them, and they don't have to go to the doctor and find out, oh, I really am not covered, or there's other issue. Something that functions, actually functions. And, you know, you can do this in months in the real world, not years, and you don't require secondary companies to make it work. So let's get back to the issue of the bill, which is providing our counties, the end users, what they've been asking for, you know, how many years now? Thank you.
And Representative Quam does sing a nice rendition of Kumbaya, so if that offer is available, you should take him up on that. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's been a little bit hard to listen to this conversation because, first of all, you know, I think there's an attempt here to undermine the credibility of the witness by somehow suggesting that she's financially invested in this and that somehow undermines her statement about what's been going on and her experience with Minsher. You know, that's really disappointing. I hope members aren't intending to go down that road. Apparently something on that yellow sheet from Republican Research might suggest that that would be a road to go down. I think that's very improper here. But facts are facts. And, you know, Minsher is, you know, did start out with a lot of difficulty. It's gotten better. It's not perfect. I think we all know that. We don't need to attack the messenger here. She's just here to tell us her experience of what is working. You know, if we step back from this a second, we think about all the money that's gone into Minsher, which has been a lot. I've heard a couple members now say, I think Representative Albright said, just imagine a program that doesn't take outside help to enroll. And Representative Quam is talking about if you need outside entities to make something work, it isn't working so well. Well, members, just think about, we have this incredibly complicated system of making sure that people have insurance so that they can get health care. There is this layer in between people and their health care that is incredibly complicated that you do need a lot of outside help with. Nobody seems to mind if insurance brokers are taking a commission. They don't work for free, but somehow if it's through Minsher, it becomes evil for people. But, and I think Representative Dean knows where I'm going with this. If we want a system that doesn't take outside help to enroll, we should get the insurance layer out and have one pool, put everybody in one pool where the risk gets absolutely spread among all of us, and people don't have this complicated decision point, you know, which thing to buy, how, what will cover me, can I afford, and we do all these things, and we have this enormous bureaucratic layer to make this thing work that isn't even about health care. So, yes, I'm suggesting we do need a single-payer system, some kind of a one-pool system, and then, frankly, we wouldn't even need Minsher, and we wouldn't need to send it to the counties either. People would just have health care, which I think most of us here probably agree that everyone should have, since we all do a lot of work around that with rare diseases, for example. Somebody with a rare disease should absolutely have health care they need. Who can dispute that? Representative Dean had a bill. So, you know, we ought to be talking about that. But in the meantime, when we've got the system we've got Minsher, it's working better. Let's not try to undermine the facts about that by attacking a woman who comes here to testify. That's really just improper in my view.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Ms. Glay, I'm not here to disparage you in any way, and I know you're trying to help in people who are, find themselves in a difficult situation. And our current structure of getting health care is probably as complicated as we can possibly make it from a government standpoint. And Obamacare and Minsure seem not to have helped much. I do support Representative Dean's bill. A couple things I just want to bring out. It's already been mentioned. You know, the uninsured rate has actually gone up recently from 4% to 6.3%. So we're actually going backwards in that area. One of the reasons Obamacare Minsure has driven up premiums and deductibles exponentially. People simply cannot afford it. I've sold health insurance since 1978. I have more people canceling, especially business owners and farmers, just canceling their health insurance. They're unable to qualify for government program, and they're going without. So, I, you know, people are just saying that's enough, all right? But the biggest thing we're actually doing with Minshew and Obamacare, we're expanding government health care. And the problem with that is government health care underpays health care providers for what their costs are, substantially. I think Medicaid pays at about 27% of cost, okay? Now, I have a critical access hospital in my district, and I have an employee who's also a customer of mine of that hospital. Just was in my office on Friday. I said, how are things going up there? She said, well, management is telling us to go home as soon as possible. We've got to save money. The facility is under tremendous pressure financially because you're seeing more and more government health care payments and less private insurance. So we're reducing access. We're damaging one of the best health care systems in the world. And as long as we continue down this road of Minshew and expanding government health care, you're going to see less access, not more. And that doesn't mean a person can't have a card that they have from the government saying they have health care. But we had testimony last session where people were waiting 40 days to get an appointment to see a general practitioner. Minshew is a disaster, not just for our citizens, but for our health care system. And the continued process down this road is going to damage access and the improvement of our health care for our citizens and not make it better. It has to be repealed. It has to be replaced with private sector principles. And we can bring the cost down and increase access. Last comment, and I know we're running out of time. While the rest of you leave, I'll just keep talking. Okay, no.
Please, no, Representative.
No, I'm just kidding. Prior to Obamacare and Minshew, we had a 9% uninsured rate in the state of Minnesota, 9%. But 6% of the 9% were eligible for a government program but had not signed up. So that means we had a 3% uninsured rate. Now, after spending tens of millions of dollars through Minshew, we wound up with a 4%. And now it's gone up to a 6.3% uninsured rate. So all we had to do was tweak our current system prior to Minshew and Obamacare, and we could have taken care of those 3% and incentivized the 6% to sign up for the government program they were eligible for. We also had MCHA, which took people in with uninsurable conditions. So I could keep going on, and in the interest of time,
thank
I
will. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And thank you, Ms. Goulin, for your testimony today.
Just a final comment. Please reconsider your position. You're damaging the situation. You're not helping. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Ms. Ring, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Julie Ring. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's a pleasure to be back in this room. I don't get over here very often anymore. Despite being excited to be back, I will be very brief, given the time left. I do want to sincerely and genuinely thank Chair Dean on behalf of the counties and personally for continuing to shine a light on the challenges we have with the current technology system that counties are using. I know many of you have sat with your county workers, have seen the challenges that they're facing in doing simple enrollment tasks in the current technology system. And we need the legislature's help to fix this. As Chair Dean indicated, we have some questions and some nervousness about this proposal, but I want to start by saying that a proposal that puts counties first in helping to design a system that we have to use is something we will always be excited about. In fact, you will see that we will be bringing some legislation forward this year more broadly than HHS to talk about system development at the state level related to a number of county systems that we have to interact in and where we engage with your constituents, because we believe that these systems do have to be tested out and counties need to be at the table in developing them. So you'll hear more from us in general on this topic. To Chair Dean's bill, we do have a number of questions and nervousness around how the proposal would work, and I appreciate your comment that this is at a beginning stage of development. Right now, there is no great mechanism for counties to jointly own a technology system, and we have concerns about how we would own, operate, and maintain it. I do see Chair Davids getting anxious. I'm doing my very best. I think I have, actually, Chair Davids. Sorry. But we are concerned about counties being placed in a difficult situation trying to operate and maintain technology systems. We've been here before asking for more investment in these systems, and we do want to work together with you to make them operate efficiently. It does none of us any good for us to be expending extra county resources to try and make systems that should make our lives easier work. So I'll make a plug to say that tomorrow is County Day here at the Capitol. We'll have 270 county commissioners running around the Capitol, and I'd ask you to reach out to your local folks and ask more about this proposal and the other technology challenges we're facing, and I'd be happy to talk to any of you more in depth individually. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And she meant that offline. Members, are there any final words from Representative Dean?
Just encourage everybody tomorrow to talk to your counties, and if you haven't done a cubicle ride-along, please ask to do that. It's well worth your while for the committee and for your constituents.
Thank you, Representative Dean, and thank you, Ms. Ring, for your testimony today. With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 2725 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2725 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Yeah. With that, we are adjourned.